Continue our study of the Gospels. If everyone please would open up to page 88 in the harmony there, you'll discover that we landed right in the middle, actually, at the end of the class, of what is Mark's. We were using Mark's account of his seventh record of demons in the course of Jesus' earthly ministry. So last week we went through the early going there on page 88, Mark's column, first verse that came to the other side of the sea in the country of the Gerasenes. You will note that in Matthew that's referred to as the Gadarenes, but as is often the case in eons of translation of any material, Bible or otherwise, there are different spellings that are found, and so Gadarenes or Gerasenes, it's exactly the same country. You're on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and of course immediately on the shore there, as you'll remember, the event of these demons entering the swine. And so when he came, verse 2, out of the boat, immediately man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs. No one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, the shackles broken in pieces. No one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up, bowed down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." So let's just start with one of Haverstock's classic, you know, expressions. What is this all about? And then I ask the chorus, "I don't know." This particular miracle is one of our more mysterious ones, if you will. There are events that take place here that we don't get any additional information about. And so as you look at it, it's a little bit bewildering. That, of course, is no reflection on the veracity of the record. This thing took place exactly as it did. God did not see fit to provide additional information. But, you know, why this man would run up and the voice that is speaking is the unclean spirit's voice. "I implore you by God, do not torment me." Well, the man himself would have no reason to suspect that he would be tormented by Jesus, but the demons, of course, do. And then, please, in Matthew's column, make sure you're taking your notes. I just like to use little balloons to draw a line around unique material in any given account. But that 29th verse there at the bottom left corner of page 88 says, "Have you come here to torment us before the time?" It's the last part of that verse. The demons knew that there was a time when they were to be tormented. What torment this is, how long it's going to last, a lot of questions, you know, we'd be very interested in understanding. We just don't know. Is it as simple as, "Take us out of this host body that we're occupying, the waterless places that we find elsewhere"? Bob, go ahead.
Matthew said that there were two men who came out demon possessed, and the other two only seemed to refer to one. What's up with that?
Right, and I missed that. Pardon me, but I've got it circled and just didn't notice. In the left-hand column, which is Matthew's account, up higher there at verse 28, "When he had come to the other side in the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him, exceedingly violent. Nobody could pass by." And when you're over in Mark and Luke both, though, only one man is mentioned. Okay, is that a problem? What does it mean that one account says there are two men and the other account says there's only one? And in fact, we'll see this in more than one occasion. I believe, brother, there's a really simple solution to this. What do you suppose it is? How many men were there? Two. There were two men. How many spoke? Probably only one, and that's why you get a record in the other two about the one man. He plays the more prominent role. The collection of demons, whichever one speaks for them, identifies them as legion. That speaking demon-possessed man plays the central role. And so I think that's all the world that it is. The demons have controlled these men to such an extent that they are absolutely brutalized. Demon possession is a thing we need to be right well grateful ended in the first century as a sign of the coming of the Messiah. It had been a couple of years since taking you through Zechariah, so I won't do it again this morning, but there in the last few chapters of Zechariah, it is abundantly plain that one of the identifying marks of the arrival of the Messiah is that there will be no more demon possession. Those of you that attended the debate that came up, and of course the debate as well with the Seventh-day Adventists. So if anybody teaches that there is demon possession today, they don't realize, of course, but they're saying that Jesus is not the Messiah. If there is demon possession today, if it was not removed from the earth as a identifier of the Messiah back in the first century, then Jesus is not the Messiah. And so there's big consequences that attend this. But in those days, it was a fearsome and fearful thing to be possessed by a demon. I see Michael coming in there. Mike, I just got to ask, how's your dad doing? Okay, so the doctors had a very bad prognosis for him, and you guys drove all the way to Spokane, and then were pleasantly surprised that he is out of the hospital then? Okay, so we're over on page 88 here, looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of what would be the seventh mention of demons in Mark's record. And just saying that wish we knew more about demon possession. We don't, because it is an identifying mark of the Messiah. And its cessation 2,000 years ago then has left us with relatively little information that God has chosen to reveal, and we're glad for that. No demon possession today. But there was a time they knew, looking into Matthew's column again, it's very bottom of 88 on the left, in which demons were going to be tormented. That is, their natural state of things, which they'd come to appreciate, I guess, you know, is going to be sorely interrupted and ended by the coming of the Messiah. Now, let's pick up the reading again in Mark's column, now on page 89 and at verse 11, which is where we closed out last week. So, the confrontation has been set up, and in verse 11, there was a big herd of swine feeding on the mountain. The demons entreated him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." And he gave permission, and coming out, Matthew tells us he gave the single word command, "Be gone." And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000, and they were drowned in the sea. Now, there is a matter-of-fact record of what transpired, and it is absolutely befuddling. Again, the demons are asking for a concession on Jesus' part. We don't want to be disembodied. So, if we can't be in these two humans, let's go to the swine. Okay, Jesus gives the permission. You can do that. And then, what do the swine instantly do? Is that suicide? Can they control these demons? People better than they can pigs. What? What does that mean? And we will never know this side of eternity. I don't know what happened there. I can imagine a bunch of scenarios. I can imagine, you know, that since we are told elsewhere that when demons come out of a man, they go through waterless places and they're seeking another host that they can occupy. And if they find somebody that has had demons, you know, cast out, then the house is swept and clean until they move in and breed seven more worse than they are. Y'all remember that story? Okay, well, so we know that takes place. So if that's the case, demons can survive, though they're uncomfortable, outside of the human body. Why would they want to be in the swine?
and is, you know, maybe it's not so painful as being without a body altogether, but then what happened with the swine? One of the suggestions, go ahead.
Jimmy, he just knew exactly what would happen, and that's why they, the pigs ran into the sea, because he killed, he defeated the demons.
Okay, that Jimmy's point is well taken. Jesus knew what was going to happen. He is the Son of God. He knows all things from the beginning. He knows this again is going to take place. Now, note though, in the conversation, did the demons know who Jesus was, the power that he had, and apparently what his intent was? Yes, they did. So they asked for a concession because they see this thing coming. Now then, demons. Do you remember the occasion where the demon is proclaiming that Jesus is the Son of God? Sure. Another occasion in the book of Acts where the apostles are identified as speaking for God. Wouldn't that seem very counterproductive for demons? You know, you'd think. But in all these cases, brethren, that kind of testimony, does it serve to elevate the reputation of Jesus or the apostles to have demons testifying for you? Not likely. These are not what you'd call reliable sources. And so I have to just wonder in the midst of all of this, if the demons didn't recognize that they might do Jesus some harm if everybody sees what Jesus does. He casts the demons out. And everybody that's present hears that they want to go into the pit and Jesus allows this. So who then becomes responsible if the demons decide to kill the pigs? Whose fault would it be in the people's minds? Jesus' fault. You all know the end from the beginning. You read the story before. What immediately happened? Jesus is in trouble. So I just wish I knew. I wish, you know, I knew if demons are incompatible with pigs. I wish I knew if the demons did it on purpose to harm Jesus. I just wish I knew a thousand things. Now, over here first, Carol, and then...
Oh, I just reminds me of when the Pharisees and the Sadducees would come before Jesus with some way that they thought that they could manipulate him. Mm-hmm. And then what the demons are doing, they're trying to think on torment us. And so they think they can manipulate him into putting them in the pig so they can survive. He puts them in the pig and off they go. And they got what they didn't want. But he gave it to them the way they asked
him. Yeah, for it. There's a fourth possibility. We can probably go to five or six.
Does the demon die when the pig dies?
Don't you wish you knew? Do the demons die when the pigs die? Now, I think the answer is no, because they go to waterless places seeking another host, you know, and there doesn't seem to be any indication that these evil spirit beings under Satan's control and torturing humans the way they do, you know, would die if they're not in a host. But maybe so. I mean, we just don't know what happened in this event.
Well, the demons' conversation demonstrates that they realize that Jesus has power and authority over them, and that if they're banished from the worldly realm, they are not able to do their quote-unquote.
Okay. We have lots of possibilities. We don't have any answers on the whys of this particular event. Therefore, do we need to know any of those things? They're great curiosities. I wish I knew, but do I need to know? No. What are we told? Because that's the point of the story. This is what God wants us to know. So, let's read on now. Verse 14. We're still in Mark's column. Verse 14. The herdsmen ran away. So there were witnesses. They reported it in the city, and where? It set off a panic. They just ran everywhere.
And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed, sitting down, clothed in his right mind, the very man who had the legion, and they became frightened. Now again, Bob pointed out there's actually two men. Does there need to be both men present this late in the story? How much time has now passed? Could have been a significant amount of time. They ran to the city, they ran around the country, see, and now people come back. Likely there has been an hour or several hours before people now are showing up. And so the other man may have gone home to say to his family, he's free, who knows. And in 16, those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine, and they began, next page, to entreat him to depart from their region. When they see this, what do they want Jesus to do? Leave! Just leave! Now, are pigs clean or unclean? Unclean. Did the Jews despise and, you know, look down on folks that were involved in this business? Yes, they did. Is it nonetheless a pretty important business? And if you've got a herd of 2,000, you got a big herd or a small one? You got a big one. For a couple of years, I sold primarily dairy feed for a company out of Quincy, Illinois. It doesn't exist anymore, but that bought out by Purina. But, you know, I sold products, dietary products, you know, supplement products for a wide range of livestock. We had a bunch of supplements for the pigs as well. But I'm here to tell you, I have a little bit of experience here. And if you've got 2,000 animals of any kind, you've got a lot of animals. And if you've got a lot of animals, what do you have in those animals? What do they represent? A tremendous amount of money. Somebody lost huge. Somebody maybe was entirely put out of business. 2,000 animals died. And come to think about it, think what that looks like in the Sea of Galilee as well. You got a pollution problem, quite literally. You've got a terrible problem with these dead animals now, you know, bloating and floating out there in this lake and washing up on the shores. It's just going to be an awful thing. This is a disaster, brethren. This is the kind of stuff, you know, where the governor declares an emergency. It's that big. And so they don't just run home. They run to the city. They run out into the country. They're telling everybody about this terrible event. And do we want it repeated? No. We put people out of business. We put, you know, terrible cost, you know, on the entire community, likely, with this event. Just leave. You're demolishing us. And then in 18, as he was getting into the boat, that's how he got there, and he had stilled the storm the day before, night before. Now he comes here, he does this one thing, goes back into the boat, they've asked him to leave. 19, he did not let him, 18, he was entreating him that he might accompany him. Now the one remaining demon-possessed man, now freed, what does he want with regard to Jesus? Make me your disciple. I haven't got anything anyway. I'll follow you wherever you go. But Jesus did not let him. He said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Now, if you've been reading ahead here with the harmony, like you do with the chronology, the chronological study, though I don't assign readings in this particular class, you know, you will have noted that we're going to have two more stories now in short order where people are told by Jesus yes or no with regard either to requests that they make or maybe what we might call temptations that they're about to face. And you're going to note as we look at these stories, Jesus does not always give the same counsel. So in this case, what's the man want? Go with Jesus. I want to be a disciple. I'll follow you wherever you go. What's Jesus' response to that request in verse 19? No. Now again, of course the hands ought to go up. Well, why? We don't know any more about it. We do it with the demons. So again, you have to speculate here. But brethren, James 3:1. Who can quote it? James 3, verse 1. Brethren, be not many teachers, knowing you shall receive a stricter judgment. Here's counsel not to become teachers. Is the Bible not full of teaching about how we ought to have teachers? Well, sure there is. But now he says, but not too many. Be careful about that. Don't be too quick yourself. And if you want to do this, you're going to face a stricter judgment. So when Jesus is approached by this man, and he is entreating him that he might accompany him, Jesus apparently recognizes either something about the man or something about the circumstances, which was mentioned a moment ago. He knows the end from the beginning. He sees that in this case, it is not wise for that man to follow Jesus. What did he want him to do? Go home, tell everybody. You got work to do, but it's not with me. See, that's it. And he had business that Jesus knew he was, love the phrase, best suited for. Not everybody does the same job. All right, so he did exactly that. Everyone marveled. His work, when he did what Jesus asked him to do, apparently very successful. Reading on into Mark 5:21. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered about him. He stayed on the shore, and one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and upon seeing him, fell at his feet and treated him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her, that she may get well and live." Now, we are told, for instance, in Luke 8 that she is an only daughter. In 24, he went off with him, back in Mark, he went off with him, and a great multitude was following him, pressing in on him. A woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians, had spent all she had, was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse, after hearing about Jesus, came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. Specifically, thanks to both Matthew and Luke on either side, she touched what of his cloak? The fringe, or depending on your translation, the hem of the garment. Hence the expression, of course, that's entered into the world's vernacular here, having touched the hem of the garment, you know, just barely. So, she touches the hem in 28. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I shall get well. And immediately the flow of her blood was dried up. She felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction, and immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around to the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" Now stop. Does Jesus know who touched him?
Yes.
Apparently yes. So it's not asking because he doesn't know. He, like the event of telling this man what he's best suited for, has a purpose in teaching, needs to identify this woman. So in 31, his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. 33, top of 92. But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Now, brethren, again, we have to do some speculating, I guess. It's not specifically stated right there. But I do know something about the woman's attitude. What was it? She was scared. She was really frightened. So she snuck up. She thought, if I can just touch it, it's just the garments, I'll be healed. Was she right?
Yes.
She's absolutely right. Okay. She was trying to slip in and do this, see, and then get away. And Jesus immediately put a stop to that. Not going to happen. Okay? Now think for a second. I know you're speculating, but still you think about it for a second. What if the word got out that all you had to do is just touch Jesus and you would get healed? What would Jesus be now facing? Mobs. An onslaught. It'd be like the Beatles. What did they have to do? If you ever saw the movie. Okay, Hard Day's Night was the movie. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. You know, touchstone of the classic American culture. Okay, what's most of the movie about? Run for your life! If people come at you headlong like that, you know, asking for you to do who knows how many, you know, different kinds of things, you can get hurt. And by the way, you can also have the whole point of your day destroyed. You lose all control of the mission that you were planning to accomplish. Jesus can't have this. And is it magic in his clothes? No! There's a power that he specifically says right here, we're told that he was thinking, that is in him. Okay? Now, I'm sure he wanted the woman healed. He just did not want misinformation or less information, you know, escaping. So he's drawing her up to say, we're going to talk about this so this crowd can understand this thing properly. Okay? So she's terrified, though. And good reason. Yeah, maybe thinking, you know, it's like I stole something from him. And brethren, you know, put yourself in her shoes for a minute. Now, how many books has she read about miraculous healing? What information is there about what the Messiah, Son of God, you know, can do with his powers? Not a lot. And so you go up and you take from him a healing. That's pretty valuable to you. Could it maybe be valuable to him? Might it diminish his power? Should you have paid him for it? Now, she does know something about doctors. What about doctors? They get paid. And don't help. He helped. See? But she swiped him. And so, she's got good reason to be afraid of some of that kind of power that she didn't even ask for what is the blessing of a lifetime. We have to give her credit for that, and that because Jesus does. And so, what is then, verse 34, using Mark's column again, Jesus' response. He said, daughter, what made you well? It was your faith that made you well. It's not my garment. It's not, you know, magic. It was your faith. Go in peace. What was her attitude? Fear, lay that aside, and be healed. In other words, I'm not taking it back. Be healed. So, Jesus then makes a comment that is going to be important to us here in a little while. What healed the woman? So, she didn't need Jesus. No, she needed Jesus. The power went out from him. Then how did her faith heal him? Her. Human pronoun. How did her faith heal her if Jesus did it and wouldn't let her go until he announced it to the crowd?
Through her actions.
Okay, there you go. Bob will break the tie. Okay? Yeah, exactly. Her faith brought her there. Her conscience, that Jimmy has pointed out, that Jesus can do this. Not that it's independent of Jesus, nor that without her having faith, Jesus couldn't heal her. He's not saying that either. Her faith is what? Brought her there. Her faith is what got her there. So her faith got her healed, but not without Jesus.
Men, and a woman would not approach.
You know, that's a pretty good point, and we see that in the Samaritan woman as well, you know, that what she did maybe was kind of taking liberties to, you know, to be that close to him. And so, again, wish I had more specifics, but what we have is what God wants us to have. So, what got her there is her faith. What healed her there is her faith. But that says nothing about whether or not Jesus could have healed her from a distance, which he did, could heal her without any faith on her part at all, raises people from the dead, for instance. See, it's a fact that Jesus wants to be known so the people understand the power that he has to heal and a relationship to faith, but not totally contingent upon it. I thought I saw another hand maybe here. Okay. Carol, yeah.
Well, are you done with this?
Yes.
I wanted to go back to Matthew 18 there on page 91. It says, my daughter has just died. Come lay hands on her. I sort of wondered, you know, why she's ill, you know, but then the other one says, lies near death, and then it says, she's just ill. So is it just that she's so ill that they think that she can't last the hour or 2 hours, she couldn't possibly be moved? Is that the reasoning maybe?
Exactly, and that would be my solution to it anyway. If you didn't hear that, back at the very top of page 91, Matthew 9 and verse 18 there, the synagogue official said, my daughter has just died. In our vernacular, in our culture, if you say my daughter has just died, we mean she's dead and I witnessed it, see, or somebody told me about it. But in their culture and in their language, that's not necessary. It's an expression of how urgent it is. He's trying to encourage Jesus to come because it is so urgent that it may already be too late. I think exactly what you said is the solution to that. Okay, so now a new event, and I realize we're moving kind of quickly, but I think it's okay. And I hate to say this; it sounds, you know, silly, but brother, can you get used to the most amazing things? I've seen three Cirque du Soleil shows. I go see a fourth in a minute. It's just, I love those acrobats. They're just, that's a great show, Cirque du Soleil. Okay, depending on when you go see. But okay, if I went to a Cirque du Soleil show every day of the week, what would happen? They couldn't do anything that would be amazing anymore. You know, you'd get bored. Now, how many miracles is Jesus doing, and what kinds of miracles is Jesus doing? Well, he's doing it by the hundreds and thousands, I guess, and everything you can imagine. And so I'm moving a little faster here because we've seen so many of these already that, I don't mean to get callous about it, you know, or jaded, but, you know, we've seen some of this material before.
In comparison to us today, we have faith. We want to just say, we can have a rich power. That's a great miracle.
Amen. The greatest one of all. And the whole point of his work in the miracles is to get us to him in faith for that, the forgiveness of our sins. Okay, so the next miracle here is this girl at the point of death. Jesus, in verse 36 of Mark, there, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, do not be afraid, only believe. There's that faith again. He allowed no one to follow with him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official. Behold, a commotion, people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. Now, they began laughing at him, but putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Now note, there's more information about this in Matthew's column at the bottom of 92. When Jesus came into the official's house and saw the flute players, now we hear about them, crowd noisy disorder, he began to say, depart, the girl has not died but is asleep, and they began laughing at him. Why are they laughing? Because she actually is dead. Did they know it? Look at Luke's column at the bottom of page 92, last verse, they began laughing at him. Why? Knowing what? She had died. So it was that urgent. She did die before they got back there. Jesus says she's not dead. Is he wrong? No. And once again, brethren, this is, I think, just a translation thing, you know, and again, in our cultures, Jesus is seeing that everybody understands exactly what he's doing. He is challenging their diagnosis. He suggests she's not dead. Why? Because he wants proof that she is. Not that he's confused by it, doesn't know. He is. She's dead. So, taking the child by the hand on the top of 93, in Mark again, he said to her, Talitha kum, which translated means little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately, the girl rose, began to walk. She was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded. By the way, that's four immediately's that we've had in Mark 5, just this one chapter. I told you at the very beginning, that's his favorite word. And things are happening very fast, and Mark shows how quickly things are happening. In 43, he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given her to eat. Now, guy wants to be a disciple, and Jesus says what? No, don't follow me, but what? Go preach. Then, woman, your faith has saved you. Jesus takes note of the faith with the healing right here. But then, faith or no faith, he gives strict orders, not just orders, but strict orders. You don't tell anybody about this. So, please look in Matthew's column at verse 26. And this news went out into all the land. Okay. Now, did they obey Jesus or not?
No.
Be really careful.
The parents may have, but no one else did.
See, there's the solution, I think, there. I don't know if the parents kept their mouth shut or not. Okay? But the girl, did everybody know how sick she was? Did they know that she was sick unto death? Did they know that she actually had died and they laughed at Jesus because of it? Okay. Did Jesus say, don't ever let her out of the bedroom because I don't want anybody to know that she's been raised? No, he just said, your job is not what? Tell anybody about this. Now again, brother, Jesus knows the end from the beginning. And so, you know, people seize on these kinds of things, and they say, see, he can't make up his mind, and all kinds of things that an unbeliever can make out of these circumstances. But Jesus knows what he's doing, dealing with the individual people and circumstances. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. In this case, no. And likely, these parents, appreciating what Jesus did, you know, did keep their mouths shut, but you can't deny the fact that the kid... 12 years old. She's in sixth grade. Okay. She went to school. The next day, the people are going to know. You can't stop that. Now, hold on just a second. Let me think about one thing and whether or not I want to get into this. Okay. Matthew 9. As I say, moving rather rapidly to 9:27, Matthew's the only one that tells us about three miracles here. So we'll go quickly. In Matthew 9:27, bottom of page 93, as Jesus passed on from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, have mercy on us, son of David. And after he had come into the house, the blind men came up to him, and Jesus said to them, do you believe, do you see a theme here that I'm able to do this? They said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes, saying, be it done to you according to your faith. And their eyes were opened. And Jesus sternly warned them, do you see a theme? See here, let no one know about this. But they went out and spread the news about him in all the land. So they just disobeyed. It says, but they went out and did this. And as they were going out, 32, behold, a dumb man, demon-possessed, was brought to him, and after the demon was cast out, the dumb man spoke, the multitudes marveled, saying, nothing like this was ever seen in Israel. Okay? Now, turning the page to 34, but the Pharisees were saying what? Have we done that before? Yeah. So again, they're just still trying to cover it up, to argue what Jesus is doing is still a bad thing. So let's press on now to Mark chapter 6 and verse 1, there on the right side of page 94. He went out from there, and he came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and the many listeners were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? What is this wisdom given to him? And such miracles as these performed by his hand. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us?" They took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor." By the way, Faye and the rest of you grammarians among us, is it okay to use a double negative? Jesus did. This reminds me of a story, true story, a friend of mine in Colorado. His son had left the door open on the house. This little kid, 4 or 5 years old, and left the door open. And dad says, "What's the matter with you? Were you born in a barn?" And Jesus said, and the kid said, "I'm sorry." "Well, Jesus was." Kind of the end of your whole argument as a parent, isn't it? I'm sorry. He comes into his hometown. Be careful this time. Is this Capernaum? No. This time we've gone back into Nazareth. Last time he was in Nazareth, what did they try to do to him? Tried to kill him. Okay? So they take offense again in verse 3. But at verse 4, we're in Mark 6. Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own household." Now watch very carefully in 5. He could do no miracle there. He could do no miracle there except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. Could he do miracles there? Well, yeah. It's not no, absolutely. And he wondered at their unbelief. Now look in Matthew's column at verse 58. He did not do many miracles there because of what? Because of their unbelief. Now, it worked out perfectly, and again, I apologize. I really had to rush, but I wanted to keep this material together this morning. Do you see all these faith references in Matthew 5 and the early going of 6? And a couple of times we may have companion verses with Matthew, Mark and Matthew. Okay? Sure, we do. Now, this faith, when you add all of those passages up, and particularly when you come to Nazareth, is Jesus saying, "Well, I would have liked to heal guys, and I tried, but I kept failing because you didn't believe, and so whenever I can't work a miracle, it's because you don't have any faith." Is that what Jesus ever said, believed, or taught? I guess said and taught the same thing. No, brethren, nothing like it. And yet, I've seen these passages used time and time again by the Pentecostal fakers of today, claiming they can work miracles and failing constantly. And whenever they fail, which is 100% of the time, there are no miracles today, but if it's seen and it's embarrassing, then what do they do every time? Why, it's all your fault. And why is it your fault, the victim, the one that's hurting? Well, because you had no faith. See, over here in Nazareth, Jesus couldn't do any miracles because they didn't have any faith. So it's all dependent on you. If you believe, I'd be able to heal you today. But it's your fault. You don't have enough faith. Brethren, these passages teach absolutely no such thing. They're contradicted by numerous other places where Jesus is healing. And we're just misunderstanding, again, the vernacular right there. What is the purpose of a miracle? Several places, we quote them all the time, Mark 16, Hebrews chapter 2, Acts 14. The purpose of a miracle is to confirm the word. And when you meet people who will not believe, you just go right on working miracles? No, because Jesus also said, you ought not to cast your pearls before swine. That's what's happening here. They tried to kill him. They're rejecting him again. All kinds of excuses. They will not believe. So fine. Then don't. But the purpose of the miracles is to produce that faith. I have worked miracles here repeatedly. You won't believe it, so why not? Because your heart is too hard to get the point of the miracle. I won't work the miracle anymore. Not that I need your faith to do it. I'm working a miracle to produce your faith. And your faith, never going to be you guys, so I'm leaving town. Okay, thank you. This is class dismissed.